right. If there are any let me just start if there by asking if there are any questions, because in my opinion, the way a person learns best is through studying areas that interest them the most, and questions are extremely important. So if you do have questions, don't hesitate to interrupt me. Okay. I'm not used to going this long anyways. Usually when I go for about 5 minutes, the boys jump right in at me. Okay. Now, the last point we discussed, I believe we were holding somewhere around Genesis 43. Okay. And we spoke last week about the fact that the idea of ambivalence, we said that's a biblical idea, that man can feel simultaneously in two opposite ways at the same time. About the same thing, event, or person even. And that, I mentioned, is something which most people associate with the advent of psychoanalysis and modern-day psychology, but actually it's an ancient, it's a biblical, in the Torah we have it, and I mentioned about the fact that there is even a bracha, a blessing that was constructed, which halacha, clearly demonstrates that idea. Now, we mentioned about the fact that it's not surprising to find them speaking, Jacob speaking about Joseph in two different ways. Sometimes he says that he's dead, and sometimes he does not exactly say that he's dead. Look at the at verse at 42:37, where he says, "And Jacob, their father, said to them that you have made me bereft." Joseph isn't here, and Simon isn't here. Now, here he includes Simon and Joseph under the same kind of a framework, as if they're both not here. But actually, he should have differentiated, because Joseph isn't there because he's dead, supposedly, and Simon isn't there because he's being incarcerated. There's a big difference between those two not being there. Yet, here he includes them both in the same phrase, showing that in one part, 36, did I say 42:36, showing that in one part of his mind he never really accepted his death. And I discovered also the rabbis make the same kind of a comment on the in 43:14, where he says that God will Kel Shakai, that God will give you compassion before the man, and he will send back to you your other brother and Benjamin. Now the rabbis say, look carefully at those words. He should have just said, and he'll send back your brother, because Simon was the only one that was incarcerated. But he didn't say, they said, he'll send back your other brother. And they say that other brother was that part of him that was looking for the other brother that was missing, namely Joseph. So Rashi mentions that point. But a careful analysis of the text bears out what the rabbis teach us. That's the oral law, actually. That the oral law teaches us, when you read between the lines, you see that the old patriarch, Jacob, never really accepted fully the death of his son. And that's why he mourned all his life until he actually met him. Because the mourning process can never be concluded if a person thinks in the back of their mind that there is a chance that the person is still alive. That's really, as you know, I mean, the tragedy is going on today where countries refuse to give information as to whether to relatives about the death of those who served in their country, you know, in wartime, and this is really a terrible thing, because it causes the person to grieve endlessly. Now, getting back to the storyline, in 43, we pick up where I mentioned last week about Reuben, that Reuben's plea was very heartfelt, and he was very sincere, but at the same time, there was something in his mind that was not rational. And as we go on with these classes, I think and I hope that a certain understanding of Jewish philosophy in general will emerge. You know, I guess it's hard to give something in one time, but I think if you listen carefully, that what you'll gain from this is a method of approach to the Bible that's unique, and that only Torah has, because we're the only ones that have the oral law, and also the ideas, the philosophical ideas, basic underlying philosophical ideas. You find a tremendous stress on rationality, and the rationality, which most people consider not a religious phenomena, and Torah is considered the highest religious phenomena. It partakes of the highest religious activity, man's knowledge. Moses was great because of his knowledge. Abraham was great because of his knowledge. And knowledge, again, as I mentioned last week, knowledge and ethics combine in man in a very specific way in the concept of the divine element of man, which is called the, in Hebrew, the Tzelem Elokim, that God created man in his image, meaning to say that he has some tool that with that tool he can tune in to God's world, which the animal kingdom cannot do. And this is considered the highest part of man. There is a blessing, for instance, which is recited when we see a great scientist, though he's not Jewish, and we don't really question him in terms of his beliefs, but if he's a great scientist and he has knowledge of the universe, we make a blessing, and the blessing is that Baruch Tov Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, blessed are thy God, King of the universe, and that Shenasan Mechachmasa Lebasadam, that gave of his wisdom to flesh and blood, meaning to man. This is the, you will see as you study the Torah carefully, you'll see the importance placed upon wisdom and knowledge. Proper knowledge of psychology, knowledge of philosophy. And this was all given at Sinai, and of course Abraham was one that discovered a tremendous amount on his own. And when we're studying here, and when he became a prophet, he received a lot of information, of course, through prophecy as well. But we're dealing here with people in this story. When you look closely, read the words carefully, you really see the depth of their perception. Now, Reuben, again, that's why Reuben's plea was rejected, because there was some stray loose emotion, a good emotion, but that's not what you need that doesn't reflect the greatness of man when he discards his mind, no matter how well-intentioned he is. In other religions, perhaps, that's considered a virtue, not in Judaism. Now, here we come to the scene where the next one that approaches the aged Jacob, offering him his guarantee and pleading with him to allow him to send his son with his favorite son Benjamin down to Egypt, and the one that does it is Judah. Now, in 43:8, we find that Judah said to his father Israel, "Send the lad with me, and we will go, we will arise, and we will go, and we will live, and we won't die. Us, you, and our young ones. I will guarantee him. You can demand him from my hands. If I don't bring him to you and place him right before you, then I will send to you all my life." And that was the guarantee. The guarantee was really, it seemed like Reuben had a guarantee. He says, "I will destroy, you can kill my both sons." But Judah really doesn't offer anything. Wherein lies the guarantee? And why did Jacob respond so readily? And it says, and Jacob in verse 11 says that, okay, he says, he tells him what to do, to bring a gift to the man from the land, certain things that he may not have had available that grew specifically in Canaan, and give him double money. We'll get into that, but you see he responded properly to Judah's guarantee. What was the guarantee? What was important? What did he hear in that guarantee? So what he heard in the guarantee was simply he didn't expect from his son the guarantee. He knew there's no possible, what kind of guarantee can you give? But what he wanted was the realization of the severity of this undertaking, and that's what Judah responded to. Judah said, "I will send to you all my days." That means that It will never leave. If I do this, I will see every day of my life I will suffer, which showed the father, which showed Jacob that he truly perceives what Benjamin means to him. And you can't ask for anything more from a human being. Now, it's interesting, but somebody raised a question, and it's a good question. The question is, if you look at his argument, he gives the guarantee, but he also has an argument. He says in verse 8, 43:8, he says, "We will arise and we will go, we will live and we won't die." Now, they knew that they were going to die if they of starvation. If there's no food, that's it, a person dies of starvation. And it says there was no food left. So let's take a look at 43. It says when they went in a war, 43:2. 43:1 says the hunger was great in the land, and it was as they concluded, they finished eating the food that they had brought from Egypt. So the father said, "Go." The father said, Jacob said, "Go back and bring some food." He brought up the issue again. Now, what exactly did Jacob have in mind? Now, obviously, he was no fool. He knew that he knew, as a matter of fact, that something has to be done, and he was really bringing the question out in front of his family to try to seek the solution, and that's why he had the dialogue. That Judah said, "We can't go," and then he said, and then they finally came to terms how to go. But he really set the stage. Jacob was the one that set the stage. He said, "Go and bring us bring back some food." Now the rabbis say that when Reuben was rejected, that Judah said to his brothers, he said, Rashi quotes it on 43:2, and Rashi says that Judah said to them, "Wait for the aged one until there is no more bread in the house," and that's why if you look at the verse ties those two events together. When they finished eating the food that they brought from Egypt, so their father said to them, "Go back and bring back some food." Now, the question, of course, is, what is bothering Rashi? And the important thing is, when one studies Rashi, people don't realize what a great scholar, what a great mind Rashi was. And when we were taught Rashi, we were always taught one thing, that whenever you look at a Rashi, you always try to think of what's bothering Rashi. In other words, what's the problem? If Rashi says something, it means something was disturbing him. He doesn't just say things. And when we were youngsters, we were always required to explain what this question, this unwritten question in Rashi was. Sometimes we were right, sometimes we were wrong. But probably most of the time wrong, because we were youngsters. But we gained that idea that you don't just approach a scholar, you have to be analytical and realize that this man is a giant mind, and don't take what he says lightly. Look into it very carefully. And the difficulty in this passage is, of course, we know that Jacob was a brilliant man. He was no fool. He was old at the time, and had a lifetime of experience. And the rabbis, as a matter of fact, say that he was the most cunning individual. As a matter of fact, he said when he met Rachel, he told her, "I am more cunning than your father Laban," who was considered, as you know, not a very honest person, very sly and dishonest individual. But the rabbis say that Jacob told Rachel privately when he met her that, "I'm not worried about his cunning. I am more sly than him. I can outsmart him." And, you know, in the Torah again, here we have a difference again in philosophy between other religions and Torah. Other religions respect a simpleton, a person who is naive, an individual who doesn't know, so to speak, about evil. We don't, in Torah, we don't believe that way. We respect the person who knows exactly what to do, who could be, if he wanted to, the slyest and most cunning individual, but who refrains from doing that because of his love of justice. Ignorance is never a virtue. If a person is ignorant about how to outsmart someone or how to be outsmarted, that is not a virtue, that's just a lack of knowledge. If he knows how to do it, if he could outsmart somebody, but he refrains because of his love of justice, because of his ethical perfection. That is a great man. Not a man that doesn't know, but a man that knows but loves justice. And Jacob was, as a matter of fact, you know, the Torah describes God that way. God, the Torah in Tanakh, I believe it is in the Song of Deborah, that we say that God is very straight with the those who are whole with Him or are complete with God, and that with the crooked ones He outsmarts them, so to speak. And we do not believe that a person, there is any virtue in just being taken by anybody. That is not a virtue. If someone is trying to actually fool you, then you have a responsibility to yourself and your family to outsmart that individual and not allow them to make you a victim. Being a victim is not a virtue. On the other hand, one is not permitted in any manner to, even the slightest manner, to victimize another individual, even fooling him with regard to a fact or taking away knowledge from him, robbing him of knowledge is considered the worst, or the worst, most unethical thing for a person to do. But again, it's because of the person's love of ethics and proper ethics that is that he is virtuous. His love of virtue. Now, over here again, getting back to the 43:2, the question in this verse, if you've been looking at the verse, there is a question that should arise. It says, and it came to pass when they completed the eating of the food that they brought from Egypt, and their father said to them, return and bring us back some food. Now, the question is, why Jacob is a very wise man, as I mentioned, cunning, smart, intelligent, and why does he wait for the last moment? Why does he wait until there's no more food left? You see, that's what's disturbing Rashi. An intelligent person has foresight. What do we say? What does the wise king say in Ecclesiastes? The wise man, his eyes are in his head, meaning he sees ahead of him. He sees the future. So here we have the great Jacob, the great patriarch, and he doesn't seem to have any foresight. But the answer is, that's why Rashi says that Judah said to them, wait for the aged one until there is no more bread in the house. That's what that was his advice. Now, apparently, if Judah gave that advice, then Judah knew that he knew the ways of his father, and he knew that this is what his father's going to do. That means it wasn't foolishness. If a person does something out of foolishness because he's emotionally overcome, then it's hard to anticipate that. When Judah anticipated what his father was going to do, it means that he knew a certain philosophy that has to do with a way of life that Jacob practiced, and he knew that this is going to take place. What was the principle? I believe the principle is a simple one, and that is that in Torah we maintain that if a person is facing a tragic, a situation that has potentially hazardous, what the person should do is wait till the last moment in such a case. Exhaust all your possibilities, all the possibilities that time can afford you. And this is a very wise idea. In my life, personally, that idea was of great value to me. When I first got married, I wanted to continue to study, and I didn't have a job, and my wife didn't have a job, and we were really wondering about how we're going to be supported. We just got married in the end of August, and it was September, and there was no means of support in sight. And what I simply did was, I said, I'm just going to wait till the last possible moment, and then, of course, I'll have to apply for some job out of town, or I guess I won't be able to continue with my studies. But thank God, a couple of weeks down the line, something did occur, did happen, and I was able to remain in Torah and studying Torah, and it definitely, I mean, not only improved my life, I mean, it changed my life. So this is just one example of where this philosophy, the philosophy of the Torah, is extremely important and is of benefit, and that is that a person shouldn't be too hasty. We all like to get out of problems right away. That's an emotion also. Sometimes it's true. Sometimes you try to avoid a problem, and you must have foresight. But on the other hand, this, when you see there is nothing, when you're exhausting all possibilities, don't make a move that would preempt exhausting all your possibilities. And that was the practice of Jacob. That's why Jacob said, who knows what's going to happen? Let's exhaust all the possibilities. He waited for the last possible moment. And that's what Judah said too, because Judah knew his father, and he knew the wisdom of his father, and that's why he waited till the opportune time. But now you take a look and you see that Jacob wasn't just a depressed man, as many people think when they read the story. Well, he was an old depressed man, he was afraid. He was a leader. And he didn't cease being a leader, even in the midst of his grief over his lost son Joseph and the danger of losing his favorite son Benjamin and the absence of his other son Simon. Even confronted with all these problems, he was a thinker. He waited for the last possible moment, exhausted all the possible chances of reality. Maybe something will happen. You can never tell. You just keep waiting and you don't know. Even though it's a small chance, but you have nothing to lose to wait for the last moment. But then, the moment Judah presented him with his offer, then immediately he comes into play in verse 11, and he starts orchestrating the approach, and he says, okay, you bring the man a gift. And he instructs them exactly what the nature of the gift is, and that's in verse 11. And then he tells them to bring. He says, bring in twice as much money, so you could repay the money that you found in your saddlebags. He said, in other words, bring twice as much money and also bring back the money that was in your saddlebags. Actually, they were counting three times. The reason why twice as much, Rashi explains, is because he says you can never tell. Maybe the price changed since the last time. So if the price of food went up, then you'll have ample money. And then he says, then in 14, he says, and God Almighty should give you compassion before the man. What was this? So as Rashi so beautifully states, he says, now that we've done everything, the only thing we're missing is prayer. And I am praying for you. And this was his prayer. So here you see the image, the reflection of the image of a brilliant sage, a brilliant individual, who in the midst of his tragedy is well aware, because his mind is never lost. He knows exactly what he's doing. He rejects Reuben. He sees an unruly emotion there. He rejects him. He accepts Judah because Judah made sense. What he said made sense. He waits for the last moment so that all possibilities are exhausted. And then, when he has to make his move, he does it properly. He prepares properly. He prepares the present to present to the man, to cater to his emotions. That's his political move. And then, of course, he prays as well. But this is not the first time that Jacob did that. As a matter of fact, we find in the beginning of the Sedra called Vayishlach, which is chapter 32. And you remember in that case he was confronting his brother Esau, and he prepared for a present. A great gift for Esau to try to appease him. He also prepared for war, as it says in verse 8, 32:8, two camps, and 9, he prepares for war, for battle. And then he prays. And starting from verse 10, 11, 12, he prays to God. And these three things are the way he prepares himself for the tragic event. Is this a religious kind of a thing? In my opinion, no, because most religions would say, well, pray, say psalms, pray, But you see, the idea, our idea of prayer is different. Our idea of prayer is not that we lose our ability to make decisions and to act. On the contrary, man is placed on this world to exhaust all the rational possibilities that exist. Praying is one of those possibilities. So when Jacob prepared to meet Esau, the first thing he did was try to appease him, use political means. Second thing he did was, if that doesn't work, we have to go to war. And third, of course, pray to God, because prayer is another means that could be very effective. But to just rely on prayer is not proper, because God wants man to act, and we don't know whether our prayers are appropriate all the time either. We don't know whether they're going to be accepted. But God wants us to work the entire framework of reality. Appeasement, political, if necessary, battle. Prayer is another means. Man has to exhaust every available possibility. The life is a challenge, and we believe in activism, not passivism, not sitting back and just praying and, you know, and expecting God to take over. This is not the philosophy of Judaism. And again, you see, Jacob acts the same exact way when it comes to the problem of his giving his dear son Benjamin over to the brothers to go to take him down to Egypt. Okay, I'm just wondering if the tape is going to run out now, because usually it runs about a half hour.
Rabbi?
Yes?
You've got about a minute and a half or so, but I have a question for you. Maybe we can turn the tape for the time that we need to, you know, for you to answer it. I was curious, did Jacob know the dream that Joseph had and told his brothers earlier that created a lot of these problems? I was just curious if he was aware of that at the time that he told the brothers.
Yes, he did know, because, as a matter of fact, when Joseph told the dreams to his brothers, the father was there and he criticized him. He said that, it's 37 verse 10, and he told it over to his father and to his brothers. And his father got angry at him and said, "What is this dream that you dreamed? Do you think that we will all, I, your mother, and your brothers are going to come to bow down to you to the ground?" So he got angry at him. He was saying that you're acting very egocentrically. And moreover, it's an impossibility because your mother is dead. So the dream is false. But the next verse says that the brothers were envious of him and the father kept the thing. People here, that with regard to Torah and science, and that is that the Torah is not a work of science. God did not give us at Sinai any kind of knowledge about physics or biology or chemistry or anything like that. He gave us knowledge of philosophy, the proper philosophy, and psychology insofar as normal psychology, that is, not the clinical psychology, normal psychology. And that is all a part of the Torah. He gave us knowledge of proper thinking, logics, a proper way to think, analysis, and, of course, Torah. But the other sciences, God allowed man to advance on his own through the generations. God apparently couldn't allow man to live without the ethical and philosophical way of life, while he can live without modern technology. So this was something that God allows man to develop. But simultaneously, there is nothing in Torah which is false from a scientific point of view. There cannot be such a thing, because God who created the universe is the same God that gave the Torah. And there is never any contradiction. And that's why I believe I mentioned once before, I mean, that we never had a type of Galileo incident, like the church condemned Galileo and tortured him, caused him to recant, retract his opinions because the church was against scientific knowledge. But in Judaism, you never have such a thing would be impossible because we respect, as I say, we make a blessing when we see a scientist, a great scientist, one who has knowledge. It means that God allowed man to have that, to be tuned into his knowledge is a blessing. And so there's nothing in Torah. As a matter of fact, Torah encourages man to study God's works. As we say in Psalms, how great are the works of God, you've made them all with wisdom. And the heavens declare the wisdom of God, the greatness of God. And in Jewish history, we've never, ever had a situation that a clash, so to speak, between science and Torah. There cannot be such a thing. We don't accept everything that science calls scientific as being scientific necessarily. Scientists call everything scientists say we don't accept necessarily. We have our own method of thinking, and what we consider a conclusive proof and evidence, conjecture is not going to impress us as being scientific fact. But anything which is scientifically proven or demonstrated, we accept and are happy to gain knowledge of. Again, I mean, I just want to caution you when I mention my reservation, and that is that some people have a mistaken notion that there are scientific facts that are against the idea of God or Judaism. That's a mistaken notion. That does not exist. At any rate, over here we come across this idea that the universe is finite. So Jacob makes use of that idea, and he says, the one who gave a limit to the universe, and he made a limit for it, in other words, it's finite, should also limit my personal tragedies. He says, because I never rested from my early youth. I had the troubles of Laban. I had the troubles of my brother Esau. I had the troubles of my wife Rachel. The troubles of my daughter Dinah, as you remember in the incident in Shechem. Troubles with Joseph. Troubles with Simon. Troubles with Benjamin. All my life I had troubles. So he said, the God of the universe, who said, die, enough, to the universe. In other words, the universe should be finite. He limited the process, the endless process of growth that apparently took place in the first 6 days of creation. He placed a limit on it. And he, too, should place a limit on my personal tragedies. Now, the reason that he has that comparison is because we believe that and you'll notice this throughout Psalms. If you look carefully at Psalms, and the important thing is to that when a person studies Torah is that God should help one who studies Torah, that it should open up his eyes to really see the main themes that are going on there. And many people read the Bible, but they just don't understand what's happening. I mean, in Psalms, you'll find throughout Psalms, you look carefully throughout Psalms, I'm not saying every time, but certainly the preponderance of the incident of times, that he always draws an analogy between the God of the universe and the God of history. It's the same God. The God who created the universe, the source of physics, the God that Einstein knew, and the God that Abraham knew, that Jacob knew, that Moses knew. It's the same source. And as a matter of fact, we have a prayer every time the new moon comes around, we have a prayer, and this is not there's nothing to do with our lunar prayers. Our celebration of Rosh Chodesh is nothing to do with any kind of primitive notion of moon worship. On the contrary, that's considered idolatrous. And what we mention when the new moon first starts its cycle, we say that we praise God that through His word He created the heavens. And he laid out the laws of the universe. And then we say that, that the laws of history with regard to the Jewish people should be fulfilled, just like the laws of the universe. So there's always this analogy between, just like God has laws with regard to the universe, He has laws with regard to history and with regard to His people. So Jacob's prayer to God was that just like the laws, there are laws of the universe, you should create laws with regard to your people, and namely Jacob, who is the founder of the people of Israel, that he should have, that there should be a limit to his personal tragedies. When a person invokes God, he always does so on two frameworks. Again, one framework is God is the author of nature and also the God of humanity. That you can't have one idea without the other. And that's why in Psalms you'll see King David always intersperses the two. We'll speak about the heavens, then we'll speak about the God of divine providence from man. So when we say a blessing, Elokeinu, our God, Melech Olam, King of the universe, who created such and such. The idea of God is always the creator of the universe, the author of all the laws of the universe, and also the one who relates to man with compassion and with kindness and who creates the setting for man to live in. So that's why Jacob used that formula. He says, the one that said that the one who laid down the limits for the universe should also lay down the limits for me personally, the limits of my tragedies. And you see, it's an interesting thing that Jacob's life was really a difficult one, one fraught with many problems. And again, here's where you see Judaism is different. Torah is different. When I say Judaism, I mean for Bnei Noach, for anyone who accepts the Torah and wants to gain knowledge from God's Torah. So the Torah way of life does not look to guarantee people an easy life. Many people turn to religion for that reason. They have problems, they have tragedies, and they turn to religion because they expect that by turning to religion, their lives are going to be changed and they're not going to have any more tragedies and everything's going to be hunky-dory, everything's going to be fine. We don't believe such a thing. We pray to God that we have a good life. Yes, we're entitled to do that, we're supposed to do that. But we never look at we never in any way try to read God's mind, so to speak. And we take a look at a patriarch like Jacob. After all, who could be as great as Jacob, one of the greatest individuals that ever existed? And the third, and the rabbis say, the third in a certain sense, the greatest of the patriarchs, founder of the nation. And yet, he had a very difficult, very, very difficult life. We don't look to religion in order to give ourselves an easy, pleasant life. We look to Torah to teach us how to face the challenges that God creates for us in our lives. And we don't. We can pray for a cessation of the troubles. That certainly is proper. But we don't expect that because a person is righteous that he's going to have a wonderful life without any difficulties, without any tragedies. We do not even think of it that way, because some of the greatest of our the greatest persons of the Torah had difficulties in their lives. What we look to the Torah is knowledge and how to face life in every in all of its challenges, and to give us the courage to do the proper thing according to God's guidance. That's what we really look for. And okay, I just wanted to mention that as a side point. Now let's get back to the main story. So we find that when Joseph he saw Benjamin there, and he said to the one that pointed on his house, he said, "Slaughter some food and prepare it, because these men are going to eat with me noontime." So the story continues, and they were, and then when the people were brought into the house, it says they were very frightened. They said that we're probably being called in because of the fact that they're going to accuse us of stealing the money, and then they're going to take us as slaves. Mm-hmm. And they went. So they went and they pleaded to the man who was in charge of Joseph's house, his steward, and they said to him, they told him the whole story, the whole lengthy story, we opened up our saddlebags and we saw the money, and we didn't do this, we don't know who did this. And he said to them, he said, "No, peace be to you." He says, your God and the God of your fathers gave you a little present. He says, I received your money. And then he brings out Simon. Okay. Now, there's 2 points here. One point is, first of all, why did Joseph, after all, he's the leader of the nation, why did he make this big feast? How could he justify this? At the feast, of course, he was really enjoying being together with his brothers, and he had a little plan in mind also, which we'll study pretty soon. But how did he justify this to the Egyptians? After all, I mean, why are these people being brought into their house and having this lavish meal together with the prime minister of the land? The reason I believe is that Joseph really taught Pharaoh, and I wrote in one of my articles, he taught Pharaoh all the ideas of Torah as a Ben Noach, and I find support for this from the verses themselves, if you read them carefully, at the beginning where the introduction between Joseph and Pharaoh. And I find a lot of support from the oral law for this as well. And as a matter of fact, the Talmud states that Joseph taught Pharaoh all the laws pertaining to vows. And Pharaoh understood very well. There's a whole tractate that deals with vows, some 80-odd pages. And it is a very difficult, deep study. And Joseph apparently conveyed to Pharaoh all these ideas. And I will go into that perhaps one time, that the with the seven laws, everybody's concerned about there's only seven laws, and vows are not one of them. But that's not true, because the seven laws are only the seven violations that one must refrain from. But there are many, many positive things that a Ben Noach should be involved with. And those things essentially have anything has to do with God. When a person makes a vow, a vow is always related to God. And many times you'll see in the Bible that they swear by God. So a swear is always related to God, even if you don't mention God's name. And Joseph had informed Pharaoh about that, so he really apprised them about much of Torah. And over here, the fairness, he set up a system that was very just. As a matter of fact, you see that he set up an income tax. This was really the first rationing system in the world that Joseph established. And then he set up an income tax system at the end of you study it at the end in Genesis 47, Genesis 47 down to verse 27, the whole story there, that the income tax was a very fair income tax. It was 20%. I think we'd be happy if we had that today. So he was very much occupied with teaching Pharaoh justice and kindness. And over here, the reason for the meal, this lavish meal for these people, the Egyptians didn't know it was his brothers, but the reason for the lavish meal ostensibly was that you don't accuse a person and then just let him go, because that's not right, because then you ruin his life. His name is the most important thing. A person's name, the wise king says that a good name is better than good oil. I mean, it's better than money, better than any kind of valuable object that the person's name. So Joseph taught Pharaoh that you must act very fairly with people. If you're suspicious of somebody, cast aspersions on an individual, and you find out your suspicion was wrong, then you must rectify the situation. Our country, unfortunately, doesn't really do that. And oftentimes people's lives were ruined. And then in the end of their lives, it comes out that they were innocent. And they suffer all their lives, and then they, I believe, who was it recently? Was it Al Jahis? I think it was. Yeah. No? I forgot who was it recently. But perhaps you know better than I do. But in our country, this happens very often. People who have their ruin because of guilt, they're considered guilty when actually they were innocent. So what Joseph was teaching the people here was that you don't do such a thing. And that if we find out that they're innocent, then we, on the contrary, we bring them into the prime minister's home, and we give them, we treat them royally. And when they leave, people know that these individuals are respected individuals. We restore their reputation, even give them a bigger reputation than they had before. So that was ostensibly the reason for this meal. But of course, that's ostensibly. The hidden motive that Joseph had was his little plan, which he was going to unravel. And the plan was that, as you may have read, what he did was when he sat down together with the brothers, so he saw Benjamin, and he even blessed Benjamin. That's in verse 29. And the end of verse 29, he blesses Benjamin. He doesn't mention about the other brothers. He just treats them more or less the same. But then afterwards, it says that he ate himself, and the Egyptians ate separately. Why? Because the Egyptians could not eat with the Hebrews, because it was an abomination to Egypt. The reason was because the oral law explains, because the Egyptians worshipped the sheep, and the Jews ate the sheep. And it doesn't necessarily mean in this meal, could very well be in this meal also, but the idea was that they couldn't see, eating in the Torah is always a great sign of identification. The Torah considers eating to be a great sign of identification. And when you eat with somebody, you identify with them, and that's why the Torah says that one is, for instance, in Exodus, it says that the other nations will call you, and you will eat from their sacrifices, and then you will intermarry, and you'll worship their gods, because the eating together is identification. One of the benefits of kosher is also that the Jews' eating has to be separate, because if he, with the idolaters, he's going to get drawn in to their ways of thinking. And you can have compassion for a person who has false ideas, but you don't want to identify with them, because once you do, then you get drawn into his ways. The fact that eating is identification, you can see in today's society when people have a business deal, they go out and they eat together, and they drink together. That's one of the reasons why the rabbis prohibited the drinking of wine together with Gentiles, because of the fact that if a Gentile even touches the wine, one is not permitted to drink the wine. This is a person who is an idolater, by the way, not a person that has the true idea of the one God, but a person who doesn't have the idea of one God. So if he touches the wine, not permitted to drink the wine. The reason why that from the touching isn't, you don't philosophize on the fact that it's the touching. It really is the drinking, but halacha has its own way of, its own formulation, its own way of operating, and that's the way it works out in this case. But the prohibition is in the case where the person is a ben Noach, where the person has the false idea of God. It's a law which is difficult to explain to someone who is a believing Christian. But the reason is because we aren't permitted to identify. And once there's a very close identification, then there's intermarriage, and then there is, what happens is that the person will start believing the same ideas as the idolater. So eating together is a very important thing. Now, the Egyptians could not eat together with the Hebrews here. Now, you see two things from this. First of all, you see, when they say the Hebrews, it wasn't just one family, obviously. But one family, it wouldn't be a practice in Egypt. It says, because this is an abomination to Egypt. So the reason from this part of the Torah, you see that Abraham had many, many followers, as the Torah mentions, hundreds of them. And that's mentioned before in Genesis. And apparently there was quite a group of people that were not just the sons of Jacob, not just the house of Jacob, but there were quite a number of people that embraced Abraham's philosophy, and they were against idolatry, and therefore they did not believe that any kind of animal has any special holiness, that it can't be eaten or anything like that. They were anti-religious, and that's why They were considered, by the way, and Maimonides points it out, that Abraham in his town was considered anti, a non-religious person, because he was against all the religious performances, rites of the time. So they considered him to be like an individual that is not a religious or righteous person. Now, the Egyptians also, they knew of the Hebrew philosophy. That was the philosophy of Abraham. And they knew that they don't believe that there are any animals that are special and unique and have holiness and like are not to be killed. So that's why they never would eat with them, because this was an abomination. It was like a horror to them to have to see one of the Hebrews eating something which they worshipped. They deified. So that's why they ate separately. But now you'll see that when they sat down together, so he gave Benjamin five times the amount of the brothers. So again, he favored Benjamin. First, he blessed him. And then the second thing he did was that he gave him five times the amount. And now, before that also is an interesting thing, that when they sat down together, Rashi explains, there's an amazing thing. Take a look at the Torah. It says, at verse 33, it says, they sat down before him, the eldest according to his age and the youngest according to his youth. And it says, and the men were astounded one to another. They were shocked, because Joseph assigned them seats in accordance with their age. And they just, how could he know that? How could he possibly know their ages? Now, Joseph did this purposefully. On the contrary, you'd think that he wouldn't want them, to be suspicious, but no, on the contrary. He wanted to show them, he wanted to create a certain image of himself in this scene. And the image was that he is a kind of, you might say, an all-knowing kind of person. They were astounded. They probably thought that he did a tremendous research on them to find out their ages and everything. But it gave them a certain respect for him, that he's not just an ordinary person, but he knows, he has a lot of knowledge. You have to be careful with this man. He has information that you wouldn't expect an ordinary person to have. So it made him appear in their eyes as being a very high stature. And he wanted that for a reason. Now, in the same verse, Rashi explains that when Benjamin was there, so he had Benjamin sit down right next to him. And he said that, why? He said, I don't have a mother, and he also doesn't have a mother. He should sit next to me. What did that show? That showed that he identified strongly with Benjamin.
Okay. Rabbi, we've got about a minute to go.
About a minute to go, okay. So the scene that he was setting up here was a very brilliant man, one. Two, he favored Benjamin. And three, not only did he favor him, but he identified with him. He says, he doesn't have a mother, I don't have a mother, he should sit next to me. And what he was doing here was simply two things. First of all, he was building up in their minds his own image. That's one. And two, he was creating a situation where he was giving favoritism to Benjamin over the brothers. And we'll see, when we continue next week, we'll see what the purpose of this plan was and how it unravels. Okay, I think we'll stop at this point. If there are any questions, I'll be glad to take them.
Okay.